From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. How far would you go for a big payout?
It'll be worth billions of dollars.
Oh, I like money.
Today, we'll talk about a controversial practice that some universities use to raise money. Plus, the Iron Pipeline. Where do illegal guns come from? A new report reveals a local source of weapons used in crimes far away. That's coming up this hour. But first, let's hop back in the break room for a moment. On Friday, I asked the panel about underage drinking and whether they thought it was safer for parents to allow kids to drink alcohol at home for the first time. Hector Fernandez of Georgia State University was one of our panelists.
Research available out there for the effects, the impact of alcohol before your brain is fully matured.
Yeah.
There is ample research to that. So to that extent, these are parents trying to be cool. These are parents trying to, you know, be friends with the kids. Guess what? That doesn't work very well. These are enablers. And I'm sorry, I do not agree with enabling.
Well, here are your first thoughts. Edward Austin Hall tweets, "We were grade schoolers in the 60s, and our parents gave us Mogan David wine every New Year's. Demystified alcohol for me, for sure." Well, l'chaim, David. We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. More than 15 million people in the United States deal with social anxiety disorder. That is an extreme fear of social situations. A dinner party, a trip to the grocery store, hosting a radio show, or even doing a meeting at work can turn into a paralyzing experience.
As I'm driving to work, I can feel the anxiety building. My stomach starts to get sick, and I start to sweat. By the time I get into work, driving up that driveway, I'm pretty much a mess.
Georgia State psychology professor Paige Anderson has developed a new technology to help people with social anxiety. She uses virtual reality software to simulate real-life settings that cause patients anxiety. The technology helps them learn to cope before they have to confront the same scenarios in the real world. Paige Anderson joins us now to talk about this. Good morning, Paige.
Good morning.
I'm in my mid-30s, and I think that my entire life people have been telling me that virtual reality is going to be the cure to X and the cure to Y. Any particular reason I shouldn't roll my eyes to this one, too?
Well, it's not necessarily virtual reality that cures social anxiety or probably anything. It's what the technology can do for you. Successful treatment for social anxiety and most anxiety disorders is the major success story for psychological science. It's based on a very simple principle that in order to overcome your fears, you have to face your fears. Now, that is much easier said than done.
I bet.
And most people don't seek treatment and sometimes can't tolerate that kind of treatment for their anxiety. So the idea of virtual reality is if you can take the first step in a virtual world, then you'll be able to do so in the real world.
But I suppose the reason a social situation would give anyone anxiety is that the other humans involved are real. What makes a virtual reality dinner party, for example, more real of an experience than just watching a movie about a dinner party?
It doesn't make it any more real of an experience, but it allows you to practice ways of thinking that will decrease your level of avoidance for the real situation or the real dinner party.
I want to play a clip from psychologist Jack Gorman of Columbia University. This is from the documentary Afraid of People. Let's take a listen to his description of social anxiety disorder.
People with social anxiety disorder become very overly sensitive about what other people are thinking about them. Interestingly, they'll often come in the office and say, "I'm paranoid," but they're not paranoid at all. What it is they have tremendous interpersonal sensitivity. So every time they're around other people, they think that people are judging them because they think they're actually doing bad.
Paige, you touched on this earlier, but what is the conventional treatment for social anxiety disorder?
The conventional treatment for social anxiety disorder is cognitive behavioral therapy. It's a therapy of thinking, that's the cognitive part, and behavior, that's the doing part. Most people with anxiety avoid the thing that they're afraid of, and that's the key aspect for recovering from anxiety, is to create new experiences so that you can create the life you want versus avoiding experiences that make your life smaller.
Let's hear one more clip here from psychologist Jack Gorman of Columbia. Here he's going to mention a few scenarios that are often difficult for socially anxious people.
They'd be afraid to use public restrooms. They become afraid to eat in restaurants because they're afraid people may be watching them and they may spill their food or choke. We've seen people who are afraid to endorse a check in front of a teller because while the teller is watching, their hand starts to shake.
We're talking about a new treatment for social anxiety disorder involving virtual reality. Paige, could you maybe walk us through one of the treatments that you might do with someone using virtual reality technology?
Sure. Well, in order to do a successful exposure therapy or the behavioral therapy, you need to have the person face their fear in a way that is controlled, repeated, and prolonged. So you can't just face your fear and recover.
I think we should emphasize that because that's something that we see in popular culture a lot. People having a sudden immersion, you know, Indiana Jones falls into the pit of snakes and spends an hour with horrifying snakes and comes out of it completely cured of his snake fear. It doesn't work like that, right?
That's right. You have to face your fear in a therapeutic way. You need to take baby steps so that you get a sense of mastery control before you face a more fearful situation. You need to do it over and over again. So if you get up to give that class presentation, rush really fast, grit your teeth and bear it and sit down, oh, it's over. That's not really successful exposure therapy. And then here's another key. You need to stay in the situation long enough for your anxiety to diminish so that you come away from the situation saying, I can handle that versus, whew, I just barely got through it and I don't think I'll get through it the next time.
Sure. But put the helmet on me, right? I mean, I'm honestly, Paige, I'm someone who's suffered from some degree of social anxiety through his life. Put the helmet on me and walk me through a treatment that you might do with me.
Sure. Well, the treatment that we just published in a study in 2013 had people put on a helmet and they had three different virtual environments that they could practice facing their fears in. One was a virtual classroom where you gave a presentation. We uploaded your presentation to a virtual podium and the classroom could have different reactions to you. Sometimes they'd nod, sometimes they'd look confused, sometimes people were checking their phone. We also had a virtual conference table so that people could practice going around the table introducing themselves, which is a high source of anxiety for people.
Yeah.
I have to say I appreciate that you brought up that you've suffered with some sort of social anxiety. I think people wouldn't imagine that radio personalities would do that. One of the things about social anxiety is that it is mistreated, misdiagnosed, and most people don't know that effective treatment is out there. Up to 92% of people with social anxiety never receive treatment, and when they do, it's on average 10 to 15 years after they've started struggling.
Well, for me, I mean, this is a good example of my particular social anxiety, which is that one of the reasons I do what I do, one of the reasons I found a home in journalism was that the kind of conversation that you and I are having right now, Paige, I know what I'm supposed to do, right? I know what my role is. I know the parameters. Everything seems really, really structured and defined. Whereas if I'm just out there trying to socialize with someone in a bar or something like that, that is much more open-ended and is much more difficult for me. Therefore, this kind of talk is a lot easier for me. My guest is Georgia State Professor Paige Anderson. I'm not making it sound too easy right now. She's an expert in how virtual reality technology can help patients with social anxiety. I suppose being a guest on a live radio program isn't necessarily one of the scenarios you've programmed into the VR helmet yet, but maybe could be something you do at some point.
Sure. You know, and the story that you tell about yourself really highlights something about social anxiety, which is... Most people minimize social anxiety because most people can relate to feeling anxious, to being worried about what other people will think of them.
Right.
So it really becomes social anxiety disorder when it becomes extreme and it starts to affect your life. And there are two ways that social anxiety can affect your life. Two of the most important ways is relationships and opportunities. So obviously you're successful. You're here on the radio. So a little social anxiety hasn't affected the opportunities, at least career-wise, that you've afforded yourself. I can't say anything about the relationships.
Yeah.
And you know, to tell another story about that, that the person who's sponsoring the research that we're doing at Georgia State is a family foundation, the Kukas Foundation, that was developed after their son, Andy Kukas, died by suicide, in part because he was misdiagnosed, with social anxiety, couldn't find the right treatment, and then had a hard time engaging with the treatment when it was available. And this was a person who was full of accomplishment and even fuller of opportunity and potential. But because of his social anxiety disorder, that wasn't realized. So this family has developed a foundation to raise awareness about social anxiety disorder so that this doesn't happen to another family. So I have a lot of admiration for that, and it really connects with my goals for my research, which is to develop treatments that are effective, practical, accessible, and acceptable to the people who need them.
Yeah, that's got to be a powerful source of motivation.
Yes.
So you were describing earlier a treatment in which you put the helmet on somebody, they see an audience to whom they're supposed to give a presentation, and the audience appears bored. They're fiddling with their phones. Very, very nerve-wracking situation. So you have your patient practice in that virtual reality environment. What's the next step? What's the next baby step toward doing that with real people?
Well, to do it in the real world. And so people with social anxiety disorders often don't set goals for social interactions for themselves in the real world. They just say something sort of vague, like, I need to get through it without being anxious. So we teach people how to set concrete, specific goals, such as going up to their TA to ask, why did I get this poor grade on a paper? And if you can do that, you've successfully met your goal. You can't have your goal be not to experience anxiety. We all experience anxiety all the time. It's not dangerous, and it shouldn't let you keep you from doing what you need to do and want to do for your life.
Paige, what do you still want to learn about social anxiety? Where does your research go next?
You know, a lot of it is about dissemination and how to get more treatment out to more people. And stigma is a major issue in getting treatment for social anxiety disorder and really all sort of mental health disorders. And that's another aspect of the technology that is appealing to me, whereas a lot of people still have stigma about going to see a therapist. Everyone is used to using technology to make their lives better.
All right. Paige Anderson is an associate professor of psychology at Georgia State University. Professor Anderson, thank you so much. Best of luck with your research.
Thank you.
Robots may be more capable than we think. Uh-oh. Students at Georgia Tech were part of a social experiment last semester. They just didn't realize it at the time. College of Computing professor Ashok Goyal teaches an artificial intelligence class every semester. He enlists the help of teaching assistants to help answer students' questions for his online class. This spring, he added an additional TA named Jill Watson. The twist? She wasn't real. She was actually an AI, artificial intelligence, and Goyal did not tell the students. Professor Goyal is teaching the same class this semester, now with two robot teaching assistants. His students have to figure out which of their TAs is human and which one is a machine. Ashok Goyal spoke with my colleague Celeste Headley in June, along with Logan Gabriel, one of the students in the online class. Celeste started the conversation by asking Logan how long it took for him to figure out that he had been communicating with a machine.
Actually, towards the end of the semester, I think, you know, after the final exam, and Professor Goyal just made a post and said, hey, wanted to let you guys know you've been in an experiment, and one of the TAs, Jill Watson, is actually an AI agent.
Was that a surprise to you?
It was an absolute surprise. The feeling that I give to other people when they ask me how I felt was kind of like watching a long movie, and at the very end, there's this huge twist that kind of just shocks you and makes you, you know, wow, I did not see that coming at all.
Professor, what was the purpose of using an AI to answer students' questions?
You know, this is a very popular course. There are about 300 students who take this course.
Wow.
And they post something like 10,000 postings on the discussion forum.
Per semester? 10,000 per semester? Wow.
That's like 100 emails per day, right?
Yeah.
So we were thinking about if we could automate some of the question answering, the frequently asked questions, because otherwise it's an enormous amount of load on the teaching staff. So that's how we started. We thought we could just perhaps automate the answering of some routine questions there so that, A, that engages the students, because students ask questions at all time of night, over the weekend, and AI can answer those questions at any time of the night or over the weekend. And at the same time, reduces the load for the teaching staff.
Did you notice, Logan, that Jill happened to seem to be awake at all hours?
You know, I didn't really notice that much during it.
Oh, looking back, you were like, oh, wait, yeah, she was awake at 2 a.m.
Right, yeah.
Now, you found out, Ashok, that there was a series of questions that seemed to get answered over and over going back years, right?
That's right. So I have been teaching this course for quite a while.
Yeah.
And every semester, there were this accumulation of 10,000 questions, about 10,000 questions. And we could see there were patterns of those questions. Students asked the same kind of questions again and again. That's what we exploited here.
But when you first released the AI, not to students, but when you first gave her a shot at answering questions, her answers were not very good. Why was that?
Indeed, you're exactly right, Celeste. Initially, the answers were not very good. And the reason was that when students ask the same questions again and again, they use different sequence of words. So I may ask a question like, when is assignment due? Or is assignment due on August 8th? Or will I be penalized if the assignment is due on August 8th and is submitted on August 9th? Same question, different forms. So initially, Jill would get confused among them.
Logan, can you give me an example of a question that you asked Jill? Do you remember one?
So I don't think I ever asked one, but I remember going back. A bunch of students also did this. We went back and we found some of the questions that Jill Watson answered. And it was you know, more basic questions that were kind of just about the syllabus, or I actually believe the one that I saw was about when an assignment was due. And yeah, Jill just gave back a very simple and complete answer.
When you went back, though, Logan, could you say, oh, yeah, that was a perfect sign this was a computer? Or does it still seem convincing when you read it, knowing that it was an AI?
Absolutely not. If there was no announcement that Jill Watson was an AI, I don't think anyone could have known that it was. It was just her perfectly verbose answer that a human would give.
Ashok, does Jill Watson pass the Turing test? Let me remind listeners, we've talked about the Turing test before here on Second Thought. The Turing test was an old standard of AI in terms of, can the AI convince a human that they are also human? Would you say that Jill Watson passes that because she convinced the student she was a human being?
Since this claim has been made by several commentators on this, I hesitate to make a claim like that. That's a very strong claim. That's been a milestone for AI for 60 years. And I would be very cautious about a claim.
Why?
Like that.
What, in what way do you think she might not pass the Turing test?
I would put it slightly differently. I would say that it is relatively easy now to pass the Turing test without really having deep intelligence. 2-3 years back, there was another contest in which somebody pretended to be a 13-year-old boy from Ukraine and pretended that he was having language problems and so on. And therefore, it appeared as if the bot had passed the Turing test. As it turned out, the bot really was not very intelligent. So Turing test is a test of intelligence, requires deeper intelligence, deeper understanding that Jill currently has. In fall, we're going to again have the same class. There'll be about 10, 12 human TAs. This time, we're going to introduce 2 or 3 AIs. We're going to mix them up, and it'll be the student's job to find out which one is the AI and which one is the human TA. So they'll be.
What do they get if they figure it out?
Ah. I guess they get to take one of the AIs out or something.
Logan, do you think you could have determined if you had been given that assignment?
Maybe, yeah. But I think it would have been very hard.
Logan, what do you take away from this? I mean, this was a class on artificial intelligence, and you didn't know you were interacting with an AI. So does that help you in terms of educational terms?
I mean, absolutely. I think it was a great example to show the path of technology that we're on. Yeah, I think it was great. Very inspiring.
What do you need to add next to Jill or whatever the AI's name will be? A sense of humor, maybe?
That would be great. We're thinking of adding some personality now. So if you're going to have two or three AIs, how do you make these two or three AIs?
How do you distinguish them?
How to distinguish them? So perhaps each one of them will have some kind of a personality. But I'm not going to tell you any more than that, because then the secret will be out.
Yeah, and then everyone will get an A. You're going to give them an automatic A for the whole semester, right?
Yeah.
No, don't hold him to that. I'm just speaking out of turn. What do you then take away from this? What does this teach you as an expert in AI about what may be our next step when it comes to artificial intelligence?
I think there are two or three major takeaway lessons. One is that AI has now come to a level of sophistication that we can, in fact, introduce AIs in the middle of human society, and humans are sometimes unable to tell which one is human, which one is AI.
Do you think that's a good thing for us not to be able to tell if it's an artificial intelligence?
I see nothing wrong with it. I think it's an exciting time. It's the beginning of a new era in which we start thinking about human intelligence and artificial intelligence in new ways.
I'm just thinking of, you know, all the science fiction movie we've seen where not knowing when you're dealing with a robot turns out really catastrophically.
But our AIs are all very nice AIs.
Famous last words. Okay, I interrupted you. And what were your other takeaways?
We are also at the beginning of an era where there's going to be a lot of social experimentation on how humans react to AIs. You know, we have been talking about AIs all this time, but now AIs are in our middle. We live with them, we play with them, we work with them, we learn with them. Would it make a difference to student behavior in the class if, let's say, Logan knew that in the middle of all of these students or NTAs are also three AIs? Would the students actually talk the same way, or will they behave differently? I don't know.
Logan, do you know the answer to that?
No, I honestly couldn't say.
Does this make you more or less interested in artificial intelligence?
Absolutely more interested.
Well, at least in that way, it totally worked.
It's a beautiful way of teaching and learning about AI.
That's Georgia Tech professor Ashok Goyal and tech student Logan Gabriel. Celeste Headley spoke with them in June about Goyal's class on artificial intelligence, which turned into a real-world AI experiment. The students did not know one of their teaching assistants was a robot, not a real person. This semester, Goyal is going to use two AI teaching assistants, and students have to figure out which one is human and which one is not. Guess what? Something you might have heard us talk about on this show before is the Iron Pipeline. That is the underground network used to ship guns from states like Georgia with relatively lax gun laws up to other states with tighter regulations. Now, many of these weapons are purchased legally here in the South before they go underground, but some of them are stolen. A new investigative report finds Atlanta has an alarming rate of guns stolen from cars. Journalist Brian Frescos did the story for The Trace, which focuses its coverage on gun issues. Brian joins me now from New York this morning. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for being here. So what's the top line takeaway of your reporting?
Well, we took away a number of things from the reporting. One thing, as you just mentioned, that guns are stolen out of cars with alarming frequency. There were about 850 stolen in Atlanta last year, just out of cars. That's more than one per day. But we also found
and that's more than other cities, I should say, according
yes,
to the research.
Yes, we have data from more than 50 cities, and that was by far Atlanta had by far the highest number of any city in our reporting. We also found that these laws or these thefts had been on the rise in a number of cities as lawmakers had rolled back restrictions on storing and carrying firearms in vehicles, including there in Georgia.
Yeah, you also looked at gun thefts in Savannah. What'd you find there?
Savannah also had a high number of thefts from vehicles. It was in the 180 range, I believe, was the number for Savannah. Savannah is one of the cities that we're still kind of working with to hammer down exactly how many were stolen. We've had some problems with the data from there.
How have you been gathering these data? Are the kinds of thefts that we're talking about, thefts of guns from cars, are these typically well documented by police?
No, they typically aren't. We found that a number of police departments don't do a very good job of tracking this problem, if they track it at all. In Savannah, for instance, They sent us a data set that detailed some of the gun thefts, but there appeared to be duplicate entries. And so what we had to do for them and what we had to do for a couple of other cities was just look at the number of cases where at least one gun was stolen. And we're trying to go back now and figure out how many of those cases resulted in more than one gun that was stolen. Like in Atlanta, we found several cases where a thief broke into a car and made off with four or five weapons.
Wow. Now, this phenomenon that we've been talking about, the iron pipeline, this is well documented. We know that there are guns that are obtained via many methods, legal and illegal, in states like Georgia, and then moved into states like your own, like New York, where it can be a lot harder to get a gun, and therefore the black market for guns is a lot more robust. But is there any reason to think that these particular guns that we're talking about, Brian, guns that are stolen from cars in cities like Atlanta and Savannah, that those end up going into the pipeline and going into other states where they're presumably used for crime?
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of reason to believe that happens. One thing that the police department told us in Atlanta is that these guns, a very small percentage of these guns that are stolen there in Atlanta are actually recovered there in Atlanta. Most of them are recovered in other places, sometimes out of state.
My guest is Brian Frescos. He's a reporter with The Trace, which is a publication focusing on gun issues. You say in your article, you point very, very quickly to Georgia's regulatory environment, very permissive regulatory environment for guns, as being related to the phenomenon that you're writing about. But ultimately, it's illegal to steal a gun from anywhere. So what do regulations have to do with gun theft?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, there's a number of things that can prevent gun theft, and there's a number of things that can increase the opportunities for gun theft. And one thing that we've seen in Georgia has made it legal for permitted gun owners to keep their firearms in their cars at work. And it has also loosened restrictions around where permit holders are allowed to carry their firearms. And what several experts have told us is that as more people are just carrying these guns around, it increases the likelihood that they're going to leave them somewhere where a thief can gain ready access to it. So we've seen a number of states, try to crack down on firearm theft. California actually was the most recent to pass a bill requiring law enforcement officers and permit holders who leave guns in their cars to either have them in a safe box or in a trunk. And I say permitted holders because non-permitted gun owners were already required to do that. So they now expanded that law to make it harder for thieves to gain access to firearms.
Any other methods that you've seen cities and states using to try to crack down on this problem, people stealing guns from cars?
Yeah, well, one thing that's been getting a lot of attention is the fact that only 9 states in D.C. require firearms that are lost or stolen to be reported to law enforcement.
Wow.
And so we've seen some areas try to take some steps to increase the reporting of lost and stolen firearms. And that really helps law enforcement crack down on trafficking and determine where this problem is occurring and deploy resources accordingly. New Orleans was the most recent one, I believe. In August, they just passed a law that required residents to report lost or stolen guns within 48 hours of discovering the loss or theft.
What did officials in Georgia tell you about how they are tackling this problem, if at all?
Well, in Georgia, I was focusing a lot of my reporting on Atlanta,
sure,
where we had seen the most gun thefts. And I spoke with one of the high-ranking police officials there, and didn't seem like at the time that they were very aware that this was a rising problem there. But after we started making inquiries and compiling the data, they created a public service announcement, a commercial, if you will, to try to encourage gun owners to lock their guns up and keep them unloaded and safe. So. So we got some good responses to our reporting, and hopefully it will prevent some gun owners from losing their firearms in the future.
Yeah, the power of investigative reporting. That's got to make you feel good. My guest is Brian Frescos. He's a reporter for The Trace. We've got a link to his story about stolen guns, guns being stolen from cars in Atlanta, and then potentially ending up in other parts of the country where they're used for crimes. That link is at gpbnews.org. Well done, Brian. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
Southwest Georgia's Technicolor homestead known as Passaquan reopened to the public recently after a multi-million dollar restoration. The seven-acre site is the life's work of eccentric artist Eddie Owens Martin. GPB's Ricky Bevington reports on Passaquan's return to its original psychedelic glory.
It's hard to describe Passaquan. You pull off a flat tree-lined road down a gravel driveway. The first thing you see is a tall pagoda and high, long wall covered with brightly colored designs.
Oh no.
Hopping out of their van, a class of fine art master students from the University of Georgia, including Catherine Miller, are shocked.
Dope.
Walk inside the wall's archway, and you're standing before a one-story house surrounded by a dizzying maze of walkways, walls, and totems, swirling with mandalas, crosses, animals, faces, and eyes painted in bright oranges, yellows, white, greens, and blues.
It's a bit overwhelming. The colors are very vibrant, and it's right there when you pull into the driveway.
Kalina Stasiak and her classmates are here for the first time to study the art of Eddie Owens Martin.
Usually when you come in, I say, welcome to Passaquan. You're no longer in Georgia. You're in the land of Passaquan, which might be the future.
Tour guide Michael McFalls is director of Passaquan and chair of the art department at nearby Columbus State University. Passaquan, according to Martin, is a utopia where the past and future come together. He started building it in the 1950s on orders, he said, from spirits in a dream.
He has a fever, right? He gets very ill. He thinks he's going to die, and he has a vision.
At the time, Martin was living in New York City, having run away from the religious constrictions of rural Georgia to live as a hustler, gambler, drag queen, and fortune teller.
But this being tells him that this is the end of the road for him unless he straightens and follows this being's ways.
Like St. Paul knocked off his horse, Martin is transformed into a Passaquoian. The being instructs him to canonize himself, St. Ohm, as in his initials, E-O-M, pack up and move to Georgia to create Passaquan.
He created his own canon of art history that he drew upon.
Catherine Gentleson is curator of folk and self-taught art at the High Museum of Art in Atlanta. She says Martin had no formal art training. He built Passaquan using imagery he saw in magazines, books, and during his own travels.
His site, Passaquan, draws on all kinds of iconography from many different world cultures, you know, Africa, Japan, China, American Indian.
Martin's art is also visionary. He was guided by internal forces, spirits that he said visited him for the rest of his life. Standing inside Passaquan, it's easy to feel spellbound by the swirl of colors and imagery. Director Michael McFalls says Martin wanted visitors to experience the past, present, and future colliding.
In his world, it's becoming this kind of pluralistic utopia for himself. In fact, Eddie thinks that you should reflect on these ancient cultures because we've lost our way, and that in the future we'll come back to those cultures.
Visitors can also reflect on the artistic and historical significance of Passaquan thanks to a multi-million dollar restoration by the Wisconsin-based Kohler Foundation, which is dedicated to preserving self-taught art environments all around the country. Kohler has donated the site to Columbus State University as an education resource for art and history students, visiting scholars, and anyone else looking to be dazzled by the eccentric visionary art of Eddie Owens Martin. For GPB News, I'm Ricky Bevington.
For that and other stories from around the state, visit gpbnews.org. College football is arguably the most popular sport in the Southeast. That certainly rings true here in Georgia, home of the College Football Hall of Fame. But historically, black colleges and universities disproportionately face a challenge out on the field. The problem stems from so-called guarantee games. These are matchups where a large school, often with a robustly funded athletics department, plays a smaller school, and they pay them a significant sum of money to schedule the game. And for reasons we're about to discuss, that smaller school is often an HBCU. Here's an example. Last year, the University of Georgia opened their season against the University of Louisiana, the University of Louisiana Monroe. The final score was 51-14 in favor of the Bulldogs. ULM collected a $1.2 million reimbursement in exchange for losing, essentially. That kind of payout can be a big help to financially strapped athletics departments, but does it put HBCU players at an unnecessary risk of harm? With us now to discuss this is Ken Rashad. He's the editor and publisher of HBCU Sports. He's joining us via Skype. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning.
And it sounds like we don't have Ken there, but also joining us is Andre Patillo. He's the athletic director for Morehouse College. Hello, Andre.
Go ahead.
Andre, are you there with me?
Yes, I'm here.
This is
Ken.
Fantastic. Can you not hear me?
Okay. Oh, all right. It sounds like we've got Ken Rashad now as well. Okay, Ken and Andre, let's go ahead and launch into this. For folks who are listening who might not be so familiar with this, why on earth would a big, rich college football team want to schedule a game with a team that they far outclass where it's really not going to be a match? Ken, can you explain that?
Well, I want to correct you on one point that you made previously with respect to the University of Georgia and Louisiana Monroe. That is not Louisiana Monroe is not an HBCU. However, Georgia did play Southern University last year, and it was somewhat lopsided. And I believe the payout for that game was somewhere in the ballpark of $600,000 to $650,000.
So we know what's in it for the HBCU. They're getting money.
Right,
But why would a bigger school want to play a smaller school that just isn't going to have any chance with them?
Well, when you have a big school like Georgia, who on any given Saturday at a home game can generate a crowd anywhere from 75,000 to 80,000 people, no matter who the opponent might be, it's considered somewhat of a win-win, if you will. They're going to still get the same amount of people in the stands. They're going to still sell the same amount of tickets, but they don't necessarily have to worry about the same type of payout. So when they play against a lower tier opponent, they basically maximize what they take in from ticket sales, and at the same time, they are able to reward the opponent, if you will, with a payout that typically is substantial compared to what they would normally play for in any given Saturday.
Okay. So, Andre Patillo, athletic director of Morehouse College, what does this have to do with HBCUs in particular? A guarantee game could be scheduled against any smaller school that doesn't have as much money for its athletics department. What does this have to do with HBCUs in particular?
Well, let me apologize because I could not hear the response that you got from the question.
Okay, we'll work on that.
Okay, but obviously, historically, black colleges, along with any other small colleges, obviously our budget is very tight. So to have an opportunity to participate in a game that would offer your program a guarantee that would help you with the finances for your athletic department, oftentimes you want to take advantage of it. I have a different approach. I don't mind playing guarantee games, but I also like to look at the welfare of my student athletes. I will not actually put my program up against a program that I think is going to cause any particular bodily harm to my student athletes, as well as jeopardize the season that we have for ourselves. We're participating in the Southern Intercollegiate Athletic Conference. We're competing for a conference championship. Our athletes are not as in depth in terms of having 1, 2, 3 guys in every position. So every athlete on my program is essential to my program. So I'm not going to put my program at risk to go out and play a ball game to receive finances just to help boost the financial economy of the institution and the athletic program at the risk of giving my student athletes the opportunity to compete for a conference championship.
It may seem obvious to you, Andre, but for folks who don't understand how this works, why would playing a football game against a vastly superior opponent be a physical risk for a player? I mean, football is inherently physically dangerous all the time. Why does that pose particular physical risk to players?
Well, you mentioned the University of Georgia and Louisiana Monroe, but you also can listen to the University of Georgia and Southern University from the SWAC, where Southern University played University of Georgia a couple of years ago, and I think everybody in the state of Georgia is aware of the fact that one of Southern's best student athletes was paralyzed, and he's paralyzed for life. And they did that at the expense of the money that they received from the University of Georgia, but personally, I think the quality in terms of the experience that student-athletes have at the institution is far more outgrows and more valuable than the actual finances that it would receive from the institution that they're competing against.
All right. My guests are Ken Rashad of HBCU Sports, and also with us is who you just heard there, Andre Patillo. He's the athletic director at Morehouse College. And Andre, you should be able to hear what Ken is saying now. We're talking about guarantee games in college football and whether or not they adversely affect HBCUs in particular. Ken, would you say that HBCUs are unfairly targeted for these games?
I wouldn't say unfairly targeted, but I believe they are targeted in ways that don't necessarily reflect football.
Explain that.
One of the allures of HBCU football is more than just what is the product on the actual field for four quarters. There is also a certain attraction to the halftime show, which are obviously the HBCU marching bands. And yeah, in cases of Southern University, Grambling, and other HBCUs who are known to have excellent band programs, that is somewhat of a target that many of these Division I programs will go after. They will say, well, you know what, in addition to the football game, we may not necessarily have quite a competition there for four quarters, but we are going to be able to entertain our crowd with a pretty excellent halftime show. And so that is also a part of the negotiations that many of these schools, the HBCUs, are aware of this, and they will say, okay, to get our football team there, that's going to cost you one thing, but if you want the band to appear as well, that's going to cost you something else. So that is, whether you call it fairly or unfairly, that is certainly a factor that is considered when these games are negotiated before they're actually played.
Andrea Patillo at Morehouse College, does what Ken described there ring true to you?
It absolutely rings true because of the entertainment that the Historically Black Colleges band provide at halftime. It's not something traditionally that the majority institution have an opportunity to witness.
Yeah.
But here again, we also participate in out-of-conference games this past year. We played Arkansas Pine Bluff. And my reason for playing Arkansas Pine Bluff, which is a Division I school out of the SWAC conference, is that I felt like we could compete. We got a guarantee for our program that would help our budget tremendously because all of the Historically Black College sports programs are suffering. So a lot of times we take those games so that we can get the guarantee that the institution is offering. But you have to sometimes decide whether or not the value of the guarantee that's being offered is worth the risk you're taking by putting your student athletes on the field with the opportunity, possibility of losing quality athletes that would help you be successful in your regular season being played.
I want to play a clip from documentary producer Jason Joseph. He created the film The Red Zone, The State of HBCU Sports. Here he's talking about the vast inequality between HBCU athletic programs and those at other major colleges. Let's listen.
In 2013, only 8 of the 21 teams in the two lone Division I HBCU conferences had an operating budget over $10 million. That's nearly half of fellow FCS counterpart Appalachian State's budget, and roughly 900% less than the budget for the University of Texas, which was $165 million.
Ken Rashad of HBCU Sports, what's going on here? Why are so many HBCU athletic departments struggling to make ends meet these days?
Well, that is a multi-layered, there's a multi-layered answer to that.
Okay.
I think in large part, to make it quick and easy, I think when you look at this from a historical standpoint, HBCUs have been historically, whether it be privately or publicly, especially at the public level, have been historically underfunded for decades. And what happens is that the process of being underfunded over time basically will lead to other unfortunate consequences that HBCUs find themselves having to address. So as a result of the entire institution not being properly funded, it obviously leads to other issues that eventually slide between the cracks and will eventually create more issues. And thus, as a result, you have administrators for various departments having to find unique or creative methods to make up for those deficits. And as a result, and I think we talked about this previously, I think personally there is a false narrative. I think in many instances, the overall argument of HBCUs playing against Division I schools is just slightly overblown, and I think it may not necessarily be as dire as some are trying to make it.
Okay. Morehouse Athletic Director Andrea Patillo, last word goes to you. What do you advise your fellow colleagues at HBCUs, your counterparts at HBCUs around the region to do when they're presented with the opportunity of a guarantee game?
Oh, well, one, I think they have to decide whether or not the guarantee that they're taking is even worth it. Obviously, we have to make business decisions all the time. And I, myself at Morehouse, obviously Morehouse is an institution that is respected all over the world. From an athletic standpoint, I'm approached quite often by some of the higher Division I schools, not the Division I majority institution, but most of the Division I historically black colleges, about whether or not I want to participate in a guaranteed game with those institutions. And at the same time, I have to put what's the value of the money that I'm receiving based on the value of the quality of life for my student athletes. Obviously, at Morehouse, we try to create the most competitive an attractive athletic program there is, but our priority is bringing our young men to Morehouse, getting a quality education so that they can graduate and participate with a quality of life. And I'm not going to jeopardize the quality of life with one of my student athletes to participate at a higher level football game because of a dollar that's being offered for my program. That's not something that I'm interested in.
And that's Andre Patillo. He's the director of athletics for Morehouse College. We also spoke with Ken Rashad, editor and publisher of HBCU Sports. Thank you, gentlemen, both so much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.